lay. Because the family had no car, her mother, Skydright Rubinku, an employee at the University of California Library, was unable to take her to the event, so Ku planned to ride the bus to the fair. The petite dancer never made it to the St. Louis World Trade Fair, however, and she also never made it home. A mother's intuition. "She's been kidnapped," Mrs. Ku told the officer who documented her daughter's disappearance on September 14, 1972. "I've had a premonition all summer that something was going to happen to change our lives. She has started hitchhiking. You know we have no car." The night before Ku was to leave, she and her mother put the finishing touches on her costume. Despite her mother's misgivings about her daughter traveling alone from California to Missouri, "I didn't want her to go. It wasn't that important for her to go to that class. But when my daughter wants things, she wants them very bad. I am no psychic, but I was afraid for her. She was so beautiful last night. I finally told her she could go if she took the bus, if she didn't hitch a ride," her mother said. Ku missed the bus, however, and made a sign to alert drivers headed in the direction of St. Louis where she was going and that she needed a ride. Ku, despite being young, was used to hitchhiking during a time when the practice was more common, so she likely was more worried about missing her performance than whose car she might end up getting into. "I told her I was very much against her hitchhiking," her mother said. "But once people hitchhike and it goes well, they can't believe anything can go wrong. Now I think something terrible has happened. That's why Aiku didn't come home last night." The officer who responded told Mrs. Ku not to worry, that her daughter had most likely teamed up with some other runaways. They suggested she put up missing persons flyers in case anyone had seen anyone matching her daughter's description. "I never believed she ran away, not even that night when she didn't come home," said Ku's mother, who nonetheless posted and sent flyers for about 3 months, stopping around the Christmas holiday. She also removed her daughter's formal Korean dancing drums and dress she had displayed on the living room wall and packed the items away. Unfortunately for Aiku Ku, she had chosen a ride with Edmund Kemper, and her mother's flyers would do little good. A third co-ed dies. She got in the car, and he drove across the bay to San Francisco, but unfortunately for her, he kept going, said Tom Honig, then a reporter with the Santa Cruz Sentinel. This little girl was terrified, obviously. Once Ku was in his car, Kemper told authorities he drove her to an isolated location in the mountains above Santa Cruz, where he said, "I pulled the gun out to show her I had it. She was freaking out. Then I put the gun away, and that had more effect on her than pulling it out." At one point, he locked himself out of his car, but a hysterical Ku let him back in. He then taped her mouth shut and pinched her nostrils together until she blacked out. He raped her while she was unconscious, then strangled her to make sure she was dead. He followed his previous modus operandi and took Ku's body back to his apartment, where he dismembered her and cut off her head. "I remember it was very exciting. There was actually a sexual thrill. It was kind of an exalted, triumphant type thing," Kemper said. "Like taking the head of a deer or an elk or something would be to a hunter. I was the hunter, and they were the victims." A trophy in the trunk. He disposed of her body, but kept Ku's head, which he stashed in the trunk of his car. It was there the next day when he attended a psychiatric parole hearing and didn't miss a beat telling the mental health professionals exactly what they wanted to hear, keeping his depravity a well-hidden secret. Kemper saw two doctors that day. The first said he saw no indication that Kemper was a danger, while the second called the depraved serial killer both normal and safe. Both recommended his juvenile records be sealed. "He has made excellent response to the years of treatment. I see no psychiatric reason to consider him to be of danger to himself or any other member of society," one of them wrote. The other suggested that Kemper's motorcycle had been more of a threat to him than he was to anyone else. Kepper was given a clean bill of health and went back to his car, and Koo's severed head in the trunk. He then went to the jury room for a few drinks. First, however, he opened his trunk to take another look at Koo's head. I suppose I was standing there looking. I was doing one of those triumphant things, too, admiring my work and admiring her beauty, and I might say admiring my catch like a fisherman, he said. I just wanted the exultation over the party. In other words, winning over death. They were dead, and I was alive. That was the victory in my case. He later buried Koo's head in his mother's garden, joking about how his mother always wanted people to look up to her. The rest of Koo's body, minus a scarf he saved as a trophy, Kemper buried in his mother's backyard. His records were sealed a month later, despite the objection of District Attorney Hanhart, who argued that given the nature of Kemper's crimes, they should have been kept open for at least 10 more years. Chapter 9. Kemper's Escalation in a City in Fear. During the time of Kemper's murders, there was another serial killer, 25-year-old Herbert Mullen, working the same territory, which had everyone's nerves on edge. Voted most likely to succeed by his high school class, Mullen had been a popular student, but experimentation with LSD made him paranoid and delusional enough to kill 13 people, including a priest and 2 young children. Police at the time believed that the same person was responsible for all the murders, making it difficult to establish a pattern, giving the difference between the violent co-ed killings and the seemingly random murders that police eventually determined were the work of Mullen. In a strange twist, Kemper and Mullen were arrested close to the same time and ended up in adjoining cells. According to Kemper, Mullen had a habit of singing and bothering people when somebody tried to watch TV. So I threw water on him to shut him up. Then, when he was a good boy, I'd give him some peanuts. Herbie liked peanuts. That was effective, because pretty soon he asked permission to sing. That's called behavior modification treatment. The rash of missing girls even led District Attorney Peter Chang to suggest that the once peaceful tourist community of Santa Cruz might be the murder capital of the world right now. At the University of Santa Cruz, a warning was posted. When possible, girls especially, stay in dorms after midnight with doors locked. If you must be out at night, walk in pairs. If you see a campus police patrol car and wave, they will give you a ride. Use the bus, even if somewhat inconvenient. Your safety is of first importance. If you are leaving campus, advise someone where you are going, where you can be reached, and the approximate time of your return. Don't hitch a ride, please. Police were also keeping a watchful eye on young hitchhikers, especially after a skull, later identified as that of Mary Ann Pesci, was discovered on Loma Prieta Mountain. When we would see someone under the age of 18 out hitchhiking, we'd pick them up and take them to juvenile hall, said Olufi. There was a big outcry because we were violating their right to hitchhike, but in reality, we were saving their lives. Everybody was talking. People on the streets were often caught talking about the missing co-eds, and a gun shop in Santa Cruz began developing a much bigger clientele as a result of the murders. In fact, one local gun dealer was selling handguns almost as fast as he could get them in, and most customers brought up the co-ed killings when they made their purchases. I've never owned a gun before, but I'm frightened, an attractive office worker told the shop owner as she slipped the snub-nosed .38 she'd just purchased into the pocket of her purse. From now on, I'm keeping this handy at all times. A tall man with a mustache was standing near the counter during the conversation, a regular that the owner knew as Big Ed. The two had also talked about co-ed murders before, so it was natural for the man to join in. The guy who's doing this to those girls must be sick. He needs help, the gun shop owner said. Sure does, responded Big Ed Kemper with a nod. Chapter 10. Cynthia Ann Shawl. All the warnings in the world were not enough to save 19-year-old Cynthia Ann Shawl, who made the terrible mistake of accepting a ride with Kemper on January 8, 1972, the same day he'd purchased a .22-caliber Ruger handgun. "I went bananas after I got that .22," Kemper said in an interview with Front Page Detective. Cynthia was babysitting to earn money for college, and one of her regular babysitting gigs was for Santa Cruz police officer Jim Connor, who had spent plenty of time drinking with Kemper at the jury room. She was young, needed money like everyone else, and she was a pleasant girl, he said. Knowing she was a student at the university, we felt very safe and knew we could trust her with our children. But on that January day, 1 week after the New Year, Cynthia made a fatal mistake when she accepted a ride with Kemper. She was on her way from her home in Santa Cruz to class at Cabrillo College in Aptos. He drove her from Santa Cruz to nearby Watsonville, where he shot her with his .22-caliber rifle, then drove the body back to his mother's duplex, where he was once again living. The next day, while his mother was away at work, he had sex with the body, then dismembered Cynthia and packed the remains in plastic bags and boxes he stashed in his closet. Her head, however, he buried outside his bedroom window as a way to keep her close. "He had an attachment to her," said Connor, who had a hard time accepting that his drinking buddy was also the man who'd killed his babysitter. "It was unbelievable, but Ed, excuse the phrase, seemed like a gentle giant," Connor said. "He was a likable kind of guy, that he could be responsible for something like this." Discovery of gruesome evidence. On January 10th, a day after Cynthia Ann Shawl disappeared, a highway patrolman driving on Highway 1 spotted two severed human arms along the side of the road. A few days later, a human torso was found floating in a lagoon near Santa Cruz. 2 days after that ghastly find, a surfer catching some waves at Capitola, south of Santa Cruz, instead caught a left hand. Soon after, a woman's pelvis washed up on shore. Each of the parts belonged to Cynthia Ann Shawl, according to fingerprints and chest x-rays. Only her head and right hand remained missing after detectives had pieced together the found body parts like a macabre horror film puzzle. Police determined she had been hacked to death, then sawed into pieces with power tools. Just as disconcerting, the time between Edmund Kemper's crimes was growing shorter, which made him all the more dangerous. "It's speeding up. It's coming to a head," Kemper said. "It wasn't a cyclical thing, but it was coming to where it was happening more often." Unknowingly for them, Kemper's last two co-ed victims had less than a month left to live. Chapter 11. Rosalind Thorpe and Allison Liu. On February 5, 1973, Kemper and his mother got into a fight, and the serial killer headed out, enraged from the incident and looking for a kill. "My mother and I had had a real tiff," he later told investigators. "I was pissed. I told her I was going to a movie, and I jumped up and went straight to the campus because it was still early." Part of him, however, was tempted to go to the phone and call the police to say, "Hello, I'm the co-ed killer," just to see his mother's reaction. But instead, he set out in search of a stand-in victim. Ed stated that the next good-looking girl he saw would die. "I might not have been much to look at myself, but I always went for pretty girls," he said, "and I was so pissed I would have killed anyone who got in the car." Unfortunately, two students who had stayed late to study, missing the last buses to leave campus, were the ones to accept his offer of a ride. 22-year-old Rosalind Thorpe was smart and usually took the bus from her apartment in downtown Santa Cruz to the university and back. But on this day, Thorpe spent too much time in the library, and when it closed at 9 p.m., she headed to the bus stop, arms full of books, hoping the last bus hadn't already passed her stop. It was a rainy night, and when Kemper spotted her standing at the bus stop, illuminated by a streetlight, it was easy for him, especially driving his 1969 Ford with the university staff parking sticker, to entice the unlucky girl into his car. Kemper rolled down the passenger window and leaned out, telling Rosalind, "The bus is gone. I know. I've missed it before, too. Can I give you a lift? It's pretty late." Likely desperate to get out of the drizzle and get home, she got in the car and they drove off. The two only drove a few blocks before Kemper noticed Alice Liu, 21, who had also spent too long at the campus library and was wondering how she was going to get home from school. When Kemper's car slowed down, Liu also noticed the university staff sticker, as well as Rosalind in the front seat, so she climbed into the back seat with no worries whatsoever. "I went down a ways and slowed down," Kemper later recalled in interviews. "I remarked on the beautiful view." Kemper's final kills were quick. All the while, still driving down the road as if he was taking the girls to their desired destination, he was maneuvering his gun from near his foot to his lap. He then picked it up and pulled the trigger, killing Rosalind, who slumped against the passenger door window. In the back seat, Alice was frantic, panicked, and struggling to escape Kemper's bullets. "I had to fire through her hands," he recalled. "She was moving around, and I missed twice." He finally hit her in the temple, but she wasn't yet dead, and he shot her again. According to some accounts, she was still alive and moaning loudly as he approached the entrance to the university. If she was, however, guards who also saw Kemper's university parking sticker believed his story that the girls were drunk and he was taking them back to their dorms. "It was getting easier to do," Kemper said, "and I was getting better at it." Instead, he took the two back to his mother's, where he took Alice's body inside to have sex with it, and Rosalind's in order to remove the bullet from her head to reduce his risk of detection, then dismembered and beheaded both girls, even as his mother and neighbors went about their normal daily activities. He said that one of his neighbors only had to turn his head in order to see what Kemper was doing, but never did. The next morning, even as friends and families were reporting both girls missing, he tossed body parts of both girls in the ocean and the surrounding hills of Alameda County, tossing the heads separately from the rest of the bodies. Too late, Santa Cruz police immediately issued an all-points bulletin so officers would be on the lookout for the girls, and students on campus immediately formed search parties and began combing the wooded 2,000-acre campus. Of course, they turned up nothing. And again, Kemper had gotten away with what seemed like the perfect murder. Almost 2 weeks later, after a storm had struck Alameda County's Eden Canyon, a road crew checking for damage from the heavy wind and rain saw what at the time they thought were mannequins. Instead, they found two decaying mutilated corpses, both missing their heads. X-rays and descriptions of the girls' families would later determine that the bodies were those of Alice Liu and Rosalind Thorpe. Later, according to John Godwin in Murder USA, other random body parts soon appeared. Occasionally, unidentifiable scraps turned up. A woman's hand without fingers, a female pelvic bone, one breast. Authorities would later learn that Kemper was a cannibal as well as a necrophiliac, which accounted for the missing body parts. It was a terrifying time for people living in and around Santa Cruz. Chapter 12. Another close call. Police were concerned when they received paperwork about a gun purchase made by Edmund Kemper, whose juvenile record prevented him from legally owning a gun. While Sergeant Michael O'Luffy, knowing Kemper's size from spending time with him at the bar, was hesitant to make the call to confiscate the gun. "Big man, big gun, and little old me," he said. He and his partner jumped into their patrol car and headed toward Kemper's mother's home on Ord Street. While Sergeant O'Luffy found Clarnell Strandberg Kemper's road easily, he had a hard time determining which of the homes or apartments belonged to her, since addresses weren't clearly marked. When he saw a car coming around the corner, Alafi decided that he and his partner should ask the driver if he knew where Kemper lived. I approached the car, and there was a guy laying across the seat, fiddling with something under the dashboard. And I said, "Excuse me," and he got out of the car, and got out of the car, and got out of the car, Alafi recalled, referring to his size. They knew immediately, based on his enormous size, that they'd found their guy. The personable young man put up no resistance when the officers requested he turn over his revolver, and he opened the trunk to retrieve it. Still, the new detective who had been injured during a tour of duty in Vietnam felt on edge all the same. "There was something about Kemper that made me uneasy when we visited his house," said Alafi, who made the call with his partner Don Smythe. When he went to the trunk of his car to get the gun, Don and I instinctively put our hands on our guns and went to either side of the car. He later told me that if we hadn't been watching him so closely, he planned to kill us. Officers were surprised to find nothing inside but the gun, wrapped in a blanket or a towel. There was no liner in the trunk, no tools, just the gun and the blanket. They took it, shrugged off the empty trunk, and left. Afterwards, however, Kemper started to worry and believed that the officers had come to his mother's duplex that day not just to get the .44 Magnum revolver he had purchased, but also to size me up, he later said. This whole process of me taking the handgun from him, he thought we were playing cat and mouse with him, Alafi said. He thought we were playing a game, that we really knew he was the murderer. He thought that authorities had finally determined that he was the co-ed killer, and his nerves began to come into play. And despite his hatred of his mother and his long-standing desire to see her dead, he didn't want her to know that he had never put his murderous past behind him, probably because he had no desire to hear the caustic words that would come out of her mouth. That visit from Alafi to confiscate Kemper's illegal gun likely accelerated Kemper's plans to kill his mother. Chapter 13. Clarnell Strandberg Kemper and Sally Hallett. One of Kemper's final victims was his mother, the woman who likely played a major role in her son devolving into one of the world's most notorious depraved serial killers. "I wanted to kill my mother since I was 8 years old," he told one interviewer. "I'm not proud of that, but she went through three husbands like a hot knife through butter. I hated her." The weekend before her death, he was driving around Ashby Avenue in Berkeley, the same place he'd picked up his first two victims, the blonde Anita and the dark-haired Marianne. There, he saw two girls, one blonde, one brunette, who were hitchhiking back to their nearby school, Mills College, to test himself. "I'm seeing if I can maintain, if I can just let go of it," he said in an interview. Kemper pulled over to pick up the girls, using the little trick of looking at his watch that made him seem casual and somewhat pressed for time, rather than in the process of planning a murder. "I got to where I could defuse the situation," said Kemper. "It's just little games I would play so they would get in the car. I had ways of developing it so they wouldn't get suspicious. It's like playing chess, then turning it into something ugly." The girls hopped in, unaware of Kemper's gun under his seat, and asked him to drive in the wrong direction, which would have taken them right past the spot where Marianne and Anita died, and Kemper would not have been able to control his urges. He tried to make them understand that they wanted to go the wrong way, and he instead drove in the opposite direction, toward the university. The girls, he later said, were stiff with fear, and when he pulled up to their dorm room, they ran out of his vehicle and up the stairs, never looking back. He sometimes wonders if they remember hitching a ride with him, and if they know how close they came to death that day in his infamous yellow Ford. "I let them out. They never even knew what was going on," he said. "I could have gotten away with it, but I didn't." A good day to kill Mom. On Good Friday of 1973, Kemper worked a half a day, and before coming home, contemplated his mother's death, which he had been planning for a week. He came home late and stopped in her bedroom to let her know he was home, hoping that she would say something nice to him to stop the inevitable murder. Instead of greeting him, the woman who was tucked in bed with a book said, "Oh my God, now I suppose you're going to want to stay up and talk all night." "I was hoping that she would say something that would stop this shit," Kemper said. But instead, the last words we shared were a fight. Hurt, Kemper left her room and went to his own bed, where he laid awake for several hours, stewing over his mother and all the past rejections. Usually she would apologize the next day when she hurt her son's feelings, but this time she didn't get a chance. At about 5 a.m., before the sun was up, Kemper murdered his mother while she was asleep, battering her to death with a claw hammer. "I walked in there with a hammer and caved in the side of her head and cut her throat," Kemper said. He then beheaded her, and after using her head for his favorite oral sex fetish, placed it ceremoniously on the mantle and used it as a dartboard. "He yelled and screamed at it and threw darts at her face," said Medina, who added that the murder of Kemper's mother was a very messy act of depravity. He also cut out her larynx and tongue and attempted to put them down the garbage disposal, but the machine spewed the remnants of his mother's words back into his face. "That seemed appropriate," he said later, "as much as she'd bitched and screamed and yelled at me over so many years. But still, her cruel voice was running through his head. Even when she was dead, she was still bitching at me. I couldn't get her to shut up," Kemper said. To ease his guilt, he headed to the bar where he tossed back a few with his cop buddies, but still felt his sadistic urges had not yet been satisfied. This time, to ease his rage, he invited his mother's best friend, 59-year-old Sally Hallett, over for dinner. Pleased at the invite, she immediately came to the house. "I came up behind her and crooked my arm under her neck, like this," he told a reporter with Front Page Detective, demonstrating for her by bending his arm at his chin. "I squeezed and just lifted her off the floor. She just hung there, and, for a moment, I didn't realize she was dead. I had broken her neck, and her head was just wobbling around, with the bones of her neck disconnected in the skin sac of her neck." Kemper then spent the night fulfilling his necrophilia fantasies with the body of his mother's best friend, then drove away from the bloody scene in Hallett's car. He left behind a note for police near his mother's body. "Approximately 5:15 a.m., Saturday. No need for her to suffer anymore at the hands of this murderous butcher. It was quick, asleep, the way I wanted it. Not sloppy and incomplete, gents. Just a lack of time. I got things to do." Chapter 14. The Arrest of the Coed Butcher. Kemper began downing caffeine pills before ditching Hallett's car in Nevada, where he rented a green Chevy Impala, which he drove for hours before landing in Pueblo, Colorado. There, he pulled over and called the Santa Cruz police from a phone booth and confessed to murdering his mother. Santa Cruz police were surprised when they received the phone call from a Pueblo phone booth on April 23, 1973. The caller was 24-year-old Edmund Kemper, the guy they called Big Ed, confessing to the murders of not only the co-eds, but also his mother and her best friend. The first time, police thought he was joking. How could the tequila-loving guy, who always said he would have been a cop if he hadn't been so big, do something so despicable? Impossible, the cops thought. And when the call became disconnected somehow, when a dispatcher pressed a wrong button, police passed the call off as a prank. But when Kemper called back, another officer, Jim Connor, whose babysitter had died at the hands of the co-ed killer, took the call. "Knowing Ed, I got on the phone, and we started talking, and I could tell that something wasn't right," Connor said. He hadn't had any sleep, and he said he had done something really bad. He said that he had killed his mother and a friend of hers, and said that they were at his house. I killed my mother and her friend, and I killed those college girls. I killed 6 of them, and I can show you where I hid the pieces of their bodies," he said. Connor kept Kemper on the phone, but sent officers to Kemper's mother's house, including Sergeant Michael Aluffy, who knew where the house was because he had been there recently to confiscate Kemper's illegally purchased 44 caliber revolver. A grisly discovery. Medina was also sent to process the crime scene, and there, despite the stench of death from several days of decomposition, the place looked relatively normal. When we arrived, there was nothing disturbed. It looked like somebody had just left on vacation, Medina said. We flipped over the mattress, and of course it was soaked with blood. It was there, on the bed now saturated with blood, that Kemper had dismembered and mutilated his 2 victims. It was also where he left the note, apologizing for not cleaning up, as he'd have to leave in such a hurry. That's the first time in the history of my career that the suspect left a note, he added. For Michael Aluffy, affectionately known as Mickey by both Kemper and his fellow officers, the crime scene brought the realization of how close he had come to discovering Kemper's grisly secret. I had this tremendous feeling of all the blood rushing out of my body, said Aluffy, who along with Medina began the search for the 2 bodies. They found Kemper's mother and her middle-aged best friend hidden in a closet. In the closet, we pulled back the sheet and saw some hair and some blood, Aluffy said. The claw hammer and a 3-foot saber with a curved bloody blade were also found nearby. Pueblo makes a big arrest, in more ways than one. Santa Cruz police contacted their Pueblo counterparts, who dispatched 2 officers to the phone booth where Kemper was waiting, still telling his story to Santa Cruz cops. The first officer to reach Kemper had been warned about Kemper's size and weaponry and approached him with caution. When they said on the radio that he was 6'9" and 280 pounds, I couldn't see anyone that big, 30-year-old David Martinez later said. I moved into the area and spotted him in the phone booth with his back to me. I came up in the cruiser, and he looked like 3 people sitting in that phone booth. Then I put on my red lights, pulled my revolver, and eased from the cruiser. I wasn't taking any chances. The father of 3 children then walked up to the phone booth, where Kemper was holding the telephone receiver. When I told him to move outside, he asked, "What do I do with the phone?" Martinez said. I told him just to drop it. Kemper, who was big enough to beat a mountain lion with a switch, Pueblo Chief of Police Robert Maber later said, put up no resistance during the arrest, and came out of the phone booth with his arms in front of him, preparing to be handcuffed. Meanwhile, Martinez waited out the 4 minutes it took for backup to arrive. To me, it seemed like 4 hours, he told a reporter with the Pueblo Chieftain. When he was asked to put his hands up, Kemper put them on top of the phone booth, he was so tall. Police asked where his weapons were, and he indicated the trunk of his nearby rented Impala. He then immediately began talking about the gory specifics of his crimes. With that kind of detail, I believe he knows what he's talking about, Maber said. After Kemper was taken in for questioning, Martinez, who passed away in 2002, a legend in his hometown for arresting one of the most notorious serial killers in history, stayed behind to search Kemper's rented car, where he turned up what he called enough ammunition to hold off an army for about a week, along with a shotgun, 2 rifles, and a blood-stained knife stashed in the glove compartment. A coat Kemper had worn, splattered with blood, was also held as evidence. The full realization of it all has not hit me yet, Martinez told the newspaper the day after the arrest, but it's not likely that I'll ever make as big an arrest again. As for Kemper, he later said he wished he tried harder to stop himself from murdering, or had turned himself in after his first 2 co-ed victims had died such gruesome, awful deaths. I wish I had given up, he said, because the regret that came later wouldn't have had to be. Chapter 15. A serial killer tells his story. Kemper, once in custody, was eager to talk about the crimes he'd committed. "He talked and talked and talked," said Olafi, who had been sent to Pueblo to escort Kemper back to Santa Cruz. He said a lot of things that were kind of disturbing, but the new detective had found his footing thanks to the complexity and depravity of the Kemper case. "After that, I was more confident as an officer, absolutely," said Olafi, who later became the chief of police before retiring in 2010. "I felt like there wasn't anything I couldn't handle at that point." As they traveled back from Colorado back to California, Kemper sat in the back seat, shackled and handcuffed, attempting to melt his large form deeper into his seat so he wouldn't be noticed by passersby. At night, Kemper was housed in local jails along the route, and during the day, they would stop for lunch at local drive-in restaurants. At one lunch spot, two young women walked by the car, causing Kemper to vomit, a reaction he said he often had, in response to attractive women, at least those not under his control. Once they were back in Santa Cruz, police impounded Kemper's battered yellow Ford, where they found human hair, some blonde, some brunette, 30-caliber ammunition, a bullet Kemper had failed to extract from an interior panel of the car, and dried blood streaked across the back seat. A search of the trunk yielded more hair along with a rash of makeshift tools, including a shovel, a raincoat, a water bottle, and an enamel-coated dishpan. A death tour. Meanwhile, Kemper took police on a grisly tour, showing them the numerous places where he had thrown, hidden, or buried body parts of his victims. Kemper and the police first stopped in Alameda County, where Kemper had lived for a time in his own apartment. He then took them to several sites where he had deposited the decapitated heads and other body parts of some of his victims. More sites were revealed in Mateo County, and then the small group arrived in Santa Cruz County, where Kemper had committed most of his crimes. There they were met by at least 20 officials, which sent Kemper into a rage. "This is no circus for me, man. Get me out of here," he told the officers, before calming down and beginning a 6-hour tour of the county. During the tour, he led them to the grave where he'd buried the torso of his first co-ed victim, Marianne Pesci, some bones and clothing he's tossed into a canyon, an arm stashed in a plastic bag. Also at the bottom of a mountain canyon, a skeleton believed to be that of budding dancer Aiko Ku, and personal items belonging to some of the victims on a ledge beneath a cliff where Kemper said he's tossed parts of Cynthia Shawl. "I am an American, and I killed Americans. I am a human being, and I killed human beings. And I did it in my society," he said. Everything was within 20 miles of Kemper's mother's apartment on Ord Street. Chapter 16. A neighborhood full of surprise. As is the case with most serial killers, neighbors of Edmund Kemper were surprised when they saw police carry the blood-soaked mattress out of their downstairs neighbor's apartment. As neighbors carried the blood-stained bed from the house, an upstairs neighbor told her sisters she had overheard officers say that Kemper had killed his mother, her friend, and the missing co-eds that had sparked months of fear in the seaside community. The sisters remember talking to Kemper about the missing college girls, and at the time he told them, "It must be some crazy person doing all this." That's why the horrified girls, who now wondered how many young women Kemper might have dismembered in the rooms beneath them, thought nothing about seeing Kemper carry cardboard boxes in and out of the apartment all the time. A few days later, police began excavating the Kemper apartment backyard. They'd only dug a few feet when they uncovered a human skull. It was that of Cynthia Shawl. "When we first heard he was confessing all this stuff, we thought it might be for the publicity," the horrified neighbor said. "But we changed our minds when the officers dug up that head." Some of the body parts were disposed of near Detective Terry Medina's home. "When I did find out that he was up here, that made me reflect on my wife," Medina said. We had two small kids up here, and she was home alone a lot. That gave me a funny feeling in the pit of my stomach. He was a predator. Chapter 17. Wondering Why. Neighbors and police, who'd spent hours hanging out with Kemper, weren't the only ones to wonder why Kemper had killed so many people. An investigator for the defense, Harold Cartwright, spent 100 hours with Kemper in an effort to determine why would this large, friendly, cooperative guy, why would he kill all these people? Cartwright said, "Never at all felt threatened at any time by Kemper. He was just sort of a gentle giant. Still, there was something that led Kemper to kill, and for Cartwright, that was his mother. You look at him and you say, okay, something happened. There's a wire that was crossed. He had a chemical imbalance. He had something. But then you look at him and you say, no, this strictly was environmental. The way he grew up, the life experiences had led him to the point that he becomes this serial mass murderer," Cartwright said. "Maybe he was killing his mother all along. Who knows?" Towards women, however, Kemper was anything but gentle. Dr. Cameron Jackson, then a psychology student, was assigned to question Kemper, and one question led him to leap from his seat, erupting like a volcano. It was just so fast. Two officers had to come in to defuse the situation, but the incident led Jackson to believe Kemper should be locked up for a very, very long time. He only once said something like, "It was the way I could control them," said Kemper's attorney James Jackson. "And that's the only thing he ever said the entire time I dealt with him that had anything to do about why he did what he did." Blaming a blast from the past. While his rage at his mother fueled his predication for murder, after his arrest, Kemper talked a bit about his childhood incarceration, the vast numbers of people being housed at the facility, and the complete lack of follow-up after he was released. "I didn't have the supervision I should have had once I got out," he said in an interview with Front Page Detective, a story that appeared in an issue with a salacious red cover, featuring a screaming young woman clad only in a bra and jeans. "I was supposed to see my parole officer every other week, and a social worker the other week. I never did. I think if I had, I would have made it," he said. "2 weeks after I was on the streets, I got scared because I hadn't seen anyone. Finally, I called the district parole office and asked if I was doing something wrong." Kemper asked if he was required to visit his parole officer, or if his parole officer would be coming to see him. According to Kemper, the man who answered the phone asked him, "What's the matter? You got a problem?" When Kemper told him, "No," the man replied, "Well, we're awfully busy with people who have. We'll get to you." No one ever did. Chapter 18. Kemper's Trial and the Aftermath. Kemper pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. It was the only strategy available for Kemper's court-appointed attorney, James Jackson, and twice attempted, unsuccessfully, to slash his wrists with a ballpoint pen to bolster his defense. On the stand, he talked about why he killed the pretty co-eds he picked up hitchhiking, and his answer were much the same as Jeffrey Dahmer's, whose attempt to assuage his abject loneliness when he lured young boys to his apartment and attempted to turn them into submissive sex slaves by drilling into their brains in hopes of turning them into zombies. "Alive," said Kemper. "They were distant, not sharing with me. I was trying to establish